Welcome, pawns, spirits, cultists, ancient horrors, one and all, to the Titans of Text podcast. We are your hosts, Danny Austerity Nissenfeld
and Eric Ostrich.
And we have with us today the incomparable Alexis Kennedy, who is the co-founder of Fail Better Games, the studio behind Fallen London and the Sunless Sea and Sky series, as well as the co-founder of Weather Factory, the team behind Cultist Simulator and the upcoming Book of Hours. This is the promised departure for us at the Titans from text-only games into, text-mostly games. We're going to delve into his journey with narrative-driven games and the intricacies of maintaining a strong narrative element within a modern game. Welcome to you, Alexis Kennedy.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's get into a bit of your history. What books were you into growing up, and did you play any games when you were a child?
Yes, and yes. When I was growing up, it was a depressingly long time ago now, and it's hard to remember the books that have shaped me, which ones I read when I was very young and which ones came in later or I reread. But obviously, you know, Tolkien and Le Guin are there as the pillars, but that's true of everyone. And so some of them are slightly less obvious things. Roger Zelazny is probably my favourite dead writer, I think, dead genre writer. I think David Mitchell is probably my favourite living writer. I came across Zelazny in my early teens, I guess. Really profound effect. I think most people who have read Zelazny and see my work will see the shadow he cast across it. Mary Renault, I keep coming back to. She wrote a lot of historical novels set in particularly ancient Greek times, and it's a really vivid evocation of a world that's gone, and her prose is absolutely lapidary. And I read The King Must Die, her retelling of the Theseus myth, again, I think early teens, and her influence is less obvious, but it was one of the things I kept going back to for Sunless Sea, which is, after all, a sort of a Mediterranean environment. There's a lot I stole from the Odyssey in terms of visiting islands. Anita Mason, she's not much talked about now, but I read one particular book of hers in, again, my early or mid-teens that really left a mark. It's called The Illusionist. It's a retelling of the story of Simon Magus, a minor character in the Bible, and a very recontextualised, a very sceptical retelling of some of the Christian, depending on your point of view, doctrine or mythology. And it was my first introduction to things like Gnosticism and views of the occult that went beyond Tolkien or Wizards and Pointy Hats, and again left a mark. And Tim Powers and James Blaylock, who I think always deserve discussing together because they were lifelong friends, and I don't know if they're still alive, and they may still be lifelong friends, and they invented a fictional author who appears in both their books. Both of those wrote very mannered, very unusual, very imaginative novels, often set in the Victorian era, but not exclusively, which I think anybody who's played in Fallen London will immediately get a good sense of. And I think when I was thinking about books beyond Le Guin and Tolkien that nobody had read, so Tom Stoppard, very famous British playwright, arguably the most famous living British playwright, I didn't really read anything except genre fiction when I was growing up. I started reading non-genre stuff when I went away and lived in Poland for a bit, and the only English language library was the British Council one, which had two shelves of genre books. So I had to expand my purview beyond that. But Tom Stoppard, I came across years before in a church. I found a couple of plays he'd written lying in a pew when I was practicing for the church choir. It's Every Good Boy Deserves Cabbage and Professional Fowl, both of which are very playful, very sinister works about language and politics. And I think that sort of playfulness of language with language wasn't something I was aware that you could do at the age of 11. So that's the book. Games. So I think there are two games that really, I played a lot of games all the way through growing up to university, but in terms of digital games, our neighbours had an Apple II. I don't think I ever played it myself, but I certainly, maybe I did, I watched our neighbour's kids playing the Wizardry games. I think the very first Wizardry game. So that was sort of early CRPG experience. And that, I guess, was foundational. The other thing was the original version of Elite, which was tremendously influential and original space sim at a time before you had space sims at all. I was 13, it was 1985 when it came out. And this whole idea of being able to explore a virtual world at your own pace was something unprecedented in games, which are normally at that point, you know, level-based. Most games couldn't even save. And that, again, crystallized my understanding of what games could be. So those are the things from my childhood, I guess.
You mentioned Roger Zelazny, who is happens to be my favorite author of any genre, frankly. What is your favorite book? Or what is the book that most affects you, I'd like to ask?
It's a good question. I think it would depend on my mood. I love Lord of Light. I think it's not aged brilliantly, but I think it's still an extraordinary novel. It's very compelling, and it became a sort of running joke that fell after I gave it to my co-founder three times, because I'd forgotten I gave it to him the first two times over the years. So eventually I started giving it to him every Christmas, like a new copy. The Amber series was where I first came across Zelazny, and that was just unlike anything I'd ever read, this sort of Chandler-esque prose that was very muscular, very poetic at the same time, coupled with these stories of compelling, larger-than-life immortals. But I think his short stories are what I love most, because they never outstay their welcome. And Zelazny was brilliant. I mean, he was a superb prose stylist, and he was a very compelling plotter. But not unlike Chandler, I think he often didn't know how to end a story. There's a lot of I think once you're a writer especially, you can see when he's making up as he goes along. And he does that brilliantly, but sometimes he runs out of road. So I reread Roadmarks, one of his minor books, again recently, and you can really tell by sort of 80% of the way through the book that he's run out of ideas and he's trying to tie the pieces together. So I think short stories.
So you mentioned Lord of Light, and I can't help mention all the games that you're known for, that you're working on, sort of have a rebirth mechanic, and especially Sunless Sea has a huge part of the Sunless series is the rebirth mechanic and the continuing in another role that's related to your other character. And of course, Lord of Light is all about rebirth, about the whole Buddhism, that techno-Buddhism that they get into there. I find that interesting that you had mentioned Lord of Light specifically.
A lot of my games do unusual things with death or centralized death. And I think a lot of Zelazny's stuff plays with the idea of death. He has a lot of immortal characters. He has a lot of characters who are reborn. Like you say in Lord of Light, or who lose their memory and continue in some other form. And I guess death in my games comes from two directions. Creatively, the story I've told before is that my co-founder and also my fiance Lottie said to me at one point, AK, are all your games about death? And I never really thought about it, but I sort of said rather embarrassingly, yes, I guess they are. My father died when I was very young, and my brother unexpectedly killed himself when I was 21. So it's had this sort of presence in my life. And I think I'm often interested in poking around the subject of death in games, where you can be playful about it and where death is fundamentally not permanent. That's the most important thing about death in games, right? Is that you can always start again, which is the exact opposite of how death works in life. And formally, I'm interested in messing around with the structure of games and the way that we play them and the kind of experiences we have with them. And we have this very clear expectation of how death works in games. It works in one of a few ways. You know, you die and you start over, or you die and you start from a checkpoint, or you die and reload because it's an RPG that doesn't expect you to die. And I'm interested in games that do something different with it. And I'm interested in building for the entire experience of playing a game, rather than just building for the experience of playing until death. So you carry bits over from loop to loop, and the game acknowledges that you've played it before, both in the fiction and the mechanic. So I think it doesn't draw directly from Zelazny, but certainly I was very interested in a lot of the things he was. And certainly he was a big influence. I wouldn't say it was unrelated.
Okay, so we've heard a bit about, I guess, your background of books and games. So how did you take the two and merge them together?
So I didn't know what I wanted to do for a very long time. I did linguistics at university. I was an English as a foreign language teacher for a bit, which was fun, but obviously not what I was meant to be I was an English school teacher, secondary school, or equivalent of high school, which really wasn't me. And then I became a software developer for a while, which a lot of sort of reasonably bright, dissatisfied people drift into. It's a good, reasonably fun living. But again, I didn't love the idea of spending the rest of my life sitting in meeting rooms talking about the details of implementing insurance software. So I always wanted to write, I mean, since I was a kid, but a lot of people do, and it seemed unattainable. I always wanted to make games, ever since I understood what games were. But that also seemed unattainable, a lot of people do. And I used to sit down and try to write. I wrote a novel, which I couldn't get published because it wasn't very good. And I kept trying to design games. I did a lot of TTRPGs when I was growing up and at university and ran a lot of my own homebrew stuff. I was interested in doing something commercially. But what I found was every time I sat down and wrote fiction, I got the itch to do game design. And every time I sat down and did game design, I got the itch to write fiction. So eventually, rather belatedly, it occurred to me that I could do something that combined the two. So I ended up trying to build a very strongly narrative game that's as much story as it was game. And this was 2008, 2009, when the sort of text-based renaissance was just taking off. So this is when we were about to see things like Choice of Games, things like all Inkle's work, 80 Days in Heaven's Vault and that lot. A lot of more innovative storytelling approaches with things like Firewatch and Oxenfree were still over the horizon. A lot of mobile games weren't really a thing, and lots of the sort of choice-based branching story mobile games, all those are way off, Reigns, all these sort of things. These are still just over the horizon, so very different era. And I was mostly a web developer at that point, so what I sat down and decided to do was web-based game. And I cannot tell you how haphazardly I made so many design decisions about the company and about the game. I just did the stuff that seemed interesting that I knew basically technically how to do. And I didn't focus on mobile games at all because I kind of thought mobile was a bit of a passing fad, which is, I think, the most wrong I've ever been about anything ever. And I calculated how long people would take to get through the Fallen London content when I first put it together. I remember I put together a spreadsheet that had four columns, which was something like casual, engaged, passionate, and bot for how a lot of people would consume the content. And what I found after a week was that the more engaged players had consumed content more quickly than I thought a bot would consume it. And this really set the tone for the next 10 years of my career, of realizing again and again that if players like story, players like content, they will consume it much faster than you expect. Only a few will. You know, lots of people will creak about on the edges, but the core players will tear through it like a forest fire tearing through the driest of forests. And so a lot of my work since then has been trying to find out how to produce content effectively enough and how to maximize the interest of content by using game mechanic. And also, I think the fact that a lot of people have quite understandably called a lot of my games grinding have been seeing me react to the initial trauma of spending, you know, days writing something that my players finish in 10 minutes. I'm still struggling to recover from that.
So the thing about games, and you've mentioned some of this, is that people want to create a more immersive experience than they get through oral storytelling or written storytelling through a novel. The player in a game, whether it's, you know, the most simple choose your own adventure book, all the way through what we have now with virtual reality, where, you know, you can actually be the character in the game. You're literally in the game as far as your senses can tell. And of course, you become the protagonist through game mechanics, through choices. How did you balance that when you were developing Fallen London, game mechanics versus just raw storytelling?
I want to cover this from a couple of angles. First of all, I think I differ slightly. Well, let me put it this way. I think a lot of people might make games in order to make more immersive stories. I don't think that's exactly why I do it. Because I think, you know, if you're reading a really good book, if you're reading Lord of Light for the first time, there aren't many more immersive experiences. You know, you're in it to the end. I remember reading George R.R. Martin, who is hell of a storyteller, but isn't a particularly outstanding prose stylist. And I still remember picking up the first Game of Thrones book, reading the first 50 pages with a slightly sort of snooty expression on my face, thinking, well, you know, I guess this is okay for a fantasy doorstop novel. And then literally waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning with like my face smeared across the pillow and drool on my pillow, because I just sort of read through until the end of the book and fallen asleep 10 pages from the end, because I was so great. So that's immersive. And like you say, VR is immersive. And whether you make a choice, sometimes even is less immersive. I played choice-based games where I am totally uninterested by badly designed choices that ask whether I want to turn left or right, or even just interested by well-designed choices, but it pulls me out of the moment and it reminds me that I'm an onlooker making decisions. So it can be more immersive, but I think it's not the only thing. And the not the only thingness of it is one of the things that I kept coming back to in Fallen London, is that people come to games and story games for many different reasons. Some people really want to pretend that they're in that virtual environment. Some people don't want to be taken out of it at all. So they want the fantasy of actually being in a nocturnal Baroque London. And some people really enjoy the mechanics of it, treat it as a challenge. And some people want to be told the story. They don't want to experience the story. And they treat the mechanics as an obstacle to get through to deal with it. So Fall of London taught me a lot of things I thought I knew about the way people consumed or wanted games are wrong, because they were based on the way I consumed or enjoyed games, and those weren't true of everyone. And I think one of the formative experiences that led to me building Fallen London and led to me learning about how to negotiate this problem was Baldur's Gate, the first game that really put Bioware on the map. So Baldur's Gate is a very traditional CRPG in lots of ways. But one of the reasons it stood out is it had a very strong, especially for the time, storyline. And you are, spoilers for a 20-year-old game, brought up in a remote monastery, and your ancestry is mysterious, and then you're forced to flee suddenly, and your mentor is killed in the middle of the night, and then you have to track down what's going on. And all this, you know, is also the opening of a dozen fantasy novels, which is why they did it. But it was the first time I felt like I'd been in a game and I could enjoy all the gamey stuff while also being inside one of these stories. So I guess immersive is an appropriate term, in that there is that feeling of being inside a story. But also, although I enjoyed the gaminess, I kept playing Baldur's Gate and being so gripped by the story, I wanted to level up at speed and plow through it. I didn't want to enjoy the gaminess. So I kept thinking, why can you make a game that's all story? Why can you make a game that's just about the interesting plot bits in between, you know, where you don't have so many popcorn fights slowing you down? And then I tried to make it with Fallen London, and instantly I realised why. I say instantly, it took me you know, a couple of months, which is that, holy hell, story takes a long time to put together. But if you design a combat system, you can keep putting combats in the game and people will keep playing them. It may take you a long time to put it together, but you've built something that gets redone. And story is definitionally the stuff that tends to happen once, whereas system is the stuff that tends to happen again and again. But because the world is complicated, and because the human, humans are ingenious creatures, there's a lot of middle ground between these two. There's stories that you can repeat. I mean, even in non-interactive stories, if you're reading an epic poem or listening to a ballad, there'll be a chorus you hear it again and again. Or there are systems which will have scripted bits that you play through once in a more storyline. You know, do one thing. You know, this is the version of the combat where you play, and it's impossible to do damage with bladed weapons because they hacked him in something specific. So I spent a lot of time learning in Fallen London how to do things that were stories that had a bit of system in them where you could repeat, and on a good day, the repetition felt like something systemic rather than something grinding. On a bad day, it just felt grinding. And that, I think, is really where I started to get excited about what still excites me, which is the point where narrative is expressed through system, and also where system expresses narrative points. So, for example, in Cultist Simulator, the fact that you have to put funds in your time verb every 60 seconds or your health starts failing is fundamental to the story. It's because I wanted to tell a story that was about the tension between art and life and the hidden and the mundane. So I want this constant beat reminding you that you got to eat, you've got to put beans on the table.
Do you feel that additional emphasis on game mechanics, such as the naval combat in Sunless Seas, enhance or detract the experience?
If I felt they detracted from the experience, I wouldn't have put them in. So let me drill down a bit. How do you feel? Do you think they enhance or detract from the experience?
I've played all of them. I like to make the comparison between Skies and Seas, not to knock the work of Failbetter on Sunless Skies, which it's an excellent game, but it feels more like a game than Sunless Sea did. Sunless Seas felt more about the story and the narrative elements than Skies does specifically. And a lot of the time in Sunless Sea, I kind of felt like, I wish I didn't have to shoot at these ships or run away from the lifebergs. I wish I didn't have to constantly run away from these things. And I could just get to where I wanted to be to advance the story. And I understand that if you took out all the naval elements of Sunless Sea, it wouldn't feel like you're driving a ship. It would just feel like Fallen London, essentially, where you're just ending up at port, this port or that port, doing something. I feel like it definitely depends on how you execute it, like in the difference between Sea and Skies. If you make it too gamey, if you make it too much about being in the sea or fighting the ships, taking Sunless Sea, if it was more about that, if you had to fight them to get items to advance more often, I definitely think it would have detracted from it. I think it can detract from the story and the immersiveness, for sure.
I think it's a very fair response, is the best way to put it. I think it's also a very good response, and you said a lot of the things that I would have said if I hadn't ducked out of answering it. And I think also it accounts for some of the defensiveness when I say, well, you know, do you think it detracted? So there's three things there, all of which are a little bit different. And the first thing is, as you say, if it wasn't for the naval combat, it would be like Fallen London. And one of the things that the naval combat and the sea travel does is act as punctuation, as pacing. So by the time you get to another island, you really care about it. And also there is a sense of threat that means that you are always watching the waters around you. Because from a thematic point of view, what I wanted people to feel in Sunless Sea was that every time they pushed out into this black unknown, they didn't know whether they're going to make it to the other side or not. Now, if you do that in a game, and this is one of the challenges of game design, if sometimes they don't make it to the other side, then they're upset because they haven't made it to the other side, but that's the risk. Similarly, if you want it to feel like somebody's really gone on a journey, one of the ways you can do that is making it take time. There are other approaches, but that was the intention. I was really ferocious about this. When I was at Failbetter, I said the ship has to stay slow or people won't feel like they've been on a journey. So having said that, I don't think the ship needed to be quite as slow as it did. We tweaked the speed over the course of development. It was the first actual video game I'd made. And I think, you know, maybe it could have been 10% faster. Maybe it could have been 20% faster. Maybe the engine upgrades could have arrived a bit faster. Definitely could have been more things to do on the voyage. But we were tuning as we went, and given the choice between making people take a long time to get somewhere and letting people get there straight away, I'd go for the first. But I want to be, and I was really specific about this in the postmortems we did at the time, it could have been better balanced. So that's the second thing. The third thing that's worth saying is that the combat, I think it was, so Liam Welton, who was the primary coder of the UI designer of the game, did most of the combat. And I think he did an amazingly good job considering how quickly he did it. Initially, we were going to do a turn-based combat thing where you actually sort of went to a separate cards, battling screen for the duration of the battle and then back to the sea. And nearly everyone hated that. And it took you out of the sea experience, and it always took time to do. And it just wasn't, I hadn't done a very good job of designing it. So towards the end of the development period, when we'd made more money than we expected to from early access, when the Kickstarter had gone a bit better than we expected to, we had more resources, we thought maybe we could actually make it real-time combat, which initially we thought was beyond us, and we did, and it wasn't that hard, and it basically works. But nobody has ever played Sunless Sea and said the combat is the best feature. It's the really made me want to play. It adds something to it, but it's got its problems. And Skies, and I very specifically don't want to cast shade on Skies, but I think it, I definitely don't want to cast shade on Skies. And I think this is really the difference in what I do now and what Failbetter do now. And this is one of the reasons why I left Failbetter and founded another studio. Because at Failbetter, I built a machine that made a particular kind of game, and they're now still happily making that, but I wanted to go on and make other kinds of games. So I'm very interested in artistic effect, even if that makes it a bit less fun. I don't want to make games not fun, because I also want to make money from games. There's lots of people making really interesting out games and scraping by on Patreon, so we want to be a bit more commercial than that. But you know, Cultist Simulator, Sun of the Sea, they're both things that, to quote one of my favourite Reddit comments, would have got the Reddit commenter failed if they handed it in as coursework for their first year of game design. And they should, because they depart from traditional wisdom on game design. The Failbetter with Southern Skies obviously wanted to make something that felt more like people's expectation of a game. And where I, you know, would be inclined to fix the Southern Sea problem by saying, okay, we're going to do other things with a long journey to make it more interesting, and we're going to do things with combat that make it serve a different purpose. Failbetter, quite reasonably, we're going to speed up the journey a bit, and we're going to lean into making combat so it's a bit more like a traditional game. And the game, I think, did pretty well, and that's fine. But that's really where the factory we said our raison d'etre is experimental narrative games with the indie aesthetic. There is room for a certain kind of game that breaks the rules a bit and does things that you probably shouldn't do, except for people who really like them, and that's what I'm interested in doing.
You mentioned the journey in Sunless Sea, and I remember when I started first playing it, the journey was difficult. And like you said, you could have been a little faster, the engine upgrades could have been a little cheaper or come sooner. And it didn't hit me how important the journey was in that game until Submariner came out. And the DLC came out, I was like, oh, this is great. I can start playing the game again and check out this submarine thing. But when you're underwater, the journey isn't the same. It's not as impactful. The backgrounds don't change. The environment you're going through doesn't change. There's less enemies. There are enemies, obviously, but there's easier ways to avoid them. And it's less difficult just being underwater in that game. And I didn't realize how central that was to Sunless Sea, was the parts that I was like, I wish I could go a little faster and get through this. Because I kept feeling like I'm never going to make it. I can't play this game because I can't accomplish it. And then Submariner came out, and I was like, wow, this is too easy now. And the game doesn't feel the same. Like, I'm just going place to place, and it doesn't even matter. I found it interesting that you pinned on that journey thing and the punctuation part of it. Like the gravedigger scene in Hamlet, the many gravedigger scenes. That interruption in a play, in a long dramatic play specifically, are really important, and they're central. You can't just have three acts of drama because people get tired of it.
Exactly this, and I, you know, very mundanely, much more mundanely than talking about Hamlet. I think about sandwiches, and I think about cocktails. Yeah, I'm currently happily sipping a gin and tonic as I sit here, and it's mostly composed of tonic water. You know, otherwise, you know, one, I would be the worse for wear, but two, you want a little bit of flavour in something that enhances and surrounds the flavour. Or a sandwich, you know, the peanut butter sandwich and sourdough bread is one of the great achievements of human civilization, and every day I've been thanked for its existence. But the sourdough bread is much less interesting than the peanut butter. But the peanut butter only composes, like, you know, 20% of it, 10% of it, whatever the sort of quantity that you get of story in Summer Sea or gin and tonic. But I don't eat peanut butter out of a jar. If I did, I would get very tired very quickly of peanut butter. So finding that balance of pacing to event is tremendously hard. It's one of the things I think that really good writers do so effortlessly. It took me a long time to realise that they were doing it. A lot of novice writers try to make sure something happens in every paragraph. All the effect that has is you get very bored very quickly because something's happening all the time in your D's train. In games, similarly, if the story comes at you all the time, you stop being able to track it because there are too many events to make sense of. So having a little bit of negative space is useful, but of course, if you overdo it, people drift away. And especially if it's a slow game, some people will always drift away. Even if most people love your game, there will be a proportion of people who say, screw that guy, you know, I have better things to do with my time.
So let's move on to your current projects.
What's that knocking?
Okay, you know, someone's knocking at my door. Sorry, guys. Let me, maybe if I ignore it. Okay, this is obviously not going away. You know what, Alexis? We'll edit this out later. Let me go see who that is. No one really even knows I'm here. I'm really, really sorry about this. No one was there. There was a letter on the ground. I don't know. It has a picture of a lantern on it.
Are you sure this is something you should be doing?
I mean, really, it's just a letter. What harm could a letter have? Let me open this. It says, "The door in the eye is closed. Heed the moth, but do not follow. Find the librarian to release the knock." Jesus Christ, what the hell? The letter, like, literally just burned up like flash paper.
What's going on over there?
God, I don't know. This is creepy. You know what? Sorry, Alexis. Let's just move on. I know you're short on time today, and I'll figure out what the heck is going on later. So you've mentioned the Book of Hours is, and I'm quoting your tweet from mid-January, you called the reason for making it to create an extremely relaxed cultist simulator standalone. Did this idea come about from user feedback from players or during the Kickstarter when the alpha phase was still going on for Cultist Simulator?
Did it. I mean, oh my God, did it. So Cultist Simulator is a very, very divisive game. I think it's easily the most divisive game I've made so far, and that's going some. Because it was intended to be a tutorial-less game where the experience of working out what's going on was the game. And it was also intended to be quite a vindictive game that would kill you if you did things wrong, because I wanted this sense of dabbling in the unknown. And if you don't pay careful attention to what's going on, you can be overwhelmed. And again, you know, tuning is hard. We made the game very quickly. The whole development cycle was less than a year. So I think I made some elements of it less vindictive. And between the elements of it that were maybe overly vindictive and the people who liked the story, liked the lore, liked the mechanics, but just really got impatient with the harshness of that, there was a lot of feedback that maybe next time people could... enjoy our writing and art and design while not constantly having to monitor their fairly conditions. So that was one thing. And on the back of, you know, similar feedback about Sun, the Sea. I'm terrified of the sea, and I want everyone else to be terrified of the sea as well. On top of that, honestly, there was my own feedback, because I've been making games for 10 years. And, you know, Fallen London is in some ways very relaxed, in some ways very mean. Sun, the Sea and Cultist Simulator are both quite brutal. And I wanted to do something a bit more chill too. I think, you know, I feel I would like a break, both from having to make mean games and from having to get the feedback that often comes with making mean games. And one of the things that I became aware of as I started to dig into the design, having done that originally, is that I have, like a lot of nerds, very strong feelings about books. And I've said... Book of Hours, I want to be a love letter to the majesty and terror of books. And it sounds like I'm joking. And I say it and smile, but I'm not entirely, perhaps not even really joking, because books contain all the wonders and terrors that could fit in the human imagination are contained in books while they're waiting to get into the human imagination. and I wanted to make a game that alluded to and allowed people to enjoy that.
So for the diehard Cultist Simulator fans out there, is there anything new that they'll be able to find in the Book of Hours?
Lots. I put together the Secret Histories, the Cultist Simulator universe, very much with the idea that I wanted to make a number of games set in it, because one of the accidental good decisions I made, of the many haphazard decisions I made at the beginning of Foul Weather's time, was to establish something that could be the beginning of a shared world, multiple games. I hate the word franchise because it's so commercial sounding, but I guess that. And I wanted to build a really rich toy for people of that frame of mind to dig into and explore and theorize about from different directions. In Cultist Simulator, people were a cultist or an occultist. They're omegas trying to achieve immortality. And here, I want to provide a new point of view of somebody who's more of a civilian in the secret wars, but deals with people who are both more and less extreme than the original player. And obviously, if you want to find out about the lore of a secret world, the occult library that contains the secrets of it is a good place to be. And finally, one of the things we keep coming back to in pre-production on Book of Hours is if knowledge is power, then librarians are some of the most powerful people in the world because they've got all the knowledge under lock and key. And even though the player is, heavy air quotes, just a librarian, they're also deciding what knowledge people who come to the library will get. So rather than being the person who comes to the Oracle and asks for information, you're the Oracle deciding what information to dole out and how that will change the course of events. And you're also curating the books that are brought to the library. So it's going to be you who decides which version of history is the one that's curated into existence, which is one of the big themes of the Cultist Simulator universe.
So looking into, and perhaps, I know it's not out yet, but even beyond the Book of Hours, how deep into this world of the secret histories, as you call it, the hidden and the macabre, are you and the other people at Weather Factory going to take us? Is there a long plan for more delving into the secret histories?
Emphatically, yes. I think there's at least two, maybe three more games. We have a parallel project to Book of Hours, which I've referred to by the codename Procopius, which we're being unusually enigmatic about, but we will be talking about at some point soon. But that is also in the Secret Histories universe, and we'll talk more about that soon. And the other two things that I would love to do, in Cultists, people saw what it was like on the Cultists' side point of view. Book of Hours is going to be, like I say, sort of a civilian. And I wanted to do a more traditional protagonist in lots of ways, where you're playing one of the hunters who tracks transgressors of the invisible laws down and does things to them. So we see another of those perspectives. And then, although it's much more challenging, although I'd love to do it, I've talked about a game where you actually play in Secret Histories terms, name level and hour level entities. So the demons and gods of the setting, you ward already against those. I'd love to do something like that. But explicitly, I've wanted to come at this from the point of view of creating a mythos that people can really sort of get into and roll around and wrap themselves up in, argue about for years. And it's going to take years for all the secrets to unroll.
And I guess finally, what other projects are out there that you would say really understand the commingling of narrative and game mechanics and get it right?
As I get more zen with age, I spend much less time saying, why didn't these folk do it differently? I would have done it like this. And much more time saying, it's interesting those folk did it differently. I would never have thought of that. And lots of folk take an approach that's very difficult, different from mine, but really interesting. So at the sort of one end of the time spectrum, this is a really old game, but it's one I always talk about. King of Dragon Pass did one of the games that first got me thinking in terms of narrative and system together. It's on iOS, I think only on iOS, not Android now. And it's a story system strategy thing about running a tribe of pseudo-Celts in a very unusual universe. Brilliant piece, completely impenetrable UI, but if you persevere, it's so good. The gentleman responsible for it's done a sequel, Six Ages, as well, which I'm eagerly waiting to come to Android. And at the much more recent end of the continuum, it's not out yet at all, but I've had my hands on a beta, Disco Elysium. Very unusual name. I think it's the best written game I have ever played in my life. And that's not something that I say lightly, because I've played a lot of really well-written games. But the writing is extraordinary. The story is labyrinthine and fascinating. The setting is really unusual. And they have done a lot of low-key but very thoughtful, unusual changes to the system and the way the system supports the narrative. It's a detective story. They call it a detective RPG because it has sort of traditional RPG-like elements set in a very unusual sort of contemporary city. And the systems include a inventory slot system where you equip beliefs and those affect the way your character interacts with the world. And a skill system where your skills are NPCs who talk to you and occasionally betray you or confuse you. And those are sort of the headline interesting points, but the thinking about the system that's gone into it is really next level. So Disco Elysium, it's an Estonian studio, and I hope to have it out this year, so I really want to play the final version.
That sounds terribly interesting.
It's so good, Danny. I very rare I sit playing a game with my mouth open. I think Planescape Torment was the last time I had that sort of drop-jawed expression.
Oh, Torment was an excellent game. And of course, Weather Factory has Cult of Simulator recently had expansions of other characters to play. And the Book of Hours is also on Steam. It's not out. When is that projected to come out?
So, I have to do the plug, or my co-founder will never forgive me. We do have the Ghoul, the Priest, and the Dancer DLC all now on Steam for Cultists. We've got Cultists on mobile as well. The DLC haven't hit there as well. A lot of people were asking for it on mobile for ages, and because it really suits the touchscreen. Book of Hours, we expect to release in the first quarter of 2021. We're usually pretty good at deadlines. We are launching the Kickstarter for it on the 29th of August. And if the Kickstarter fails, we probably won't make it, because even if we can fund it, then if a Kickstarter fails, it's a pretty good sign that actually there's not really enough interest in the game. And I do worry sometimes that my Twitter is a bit of an echo chamber and that maybe there aren't that many people in the world interested in a library RPG. But we'll see. 29th of August.
So I'd like to thank you for coming on the podcast and talking to us and relaying all this amazing information about your life and Weather Factory's efforts and Fall in London and all of that. Just thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for asking me a bunch of interesting and distinctive questions.
I never ask a man what his business is, for it never interests me. What I ask him about are his thoughts and dreams.